Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another week of The Realignment. Great episode today. I'm speaking with Cambridge professor Christopher Marcus about his new book, Mao and Markets, The Communist Roots of Chinese Enterprise. This is a fascinating episode for me because I spent most of my time on the show focused on the foreign policy angle when it comes to China and the Chinese Communist Party. Lots of episodes on Taiwan, great power competition, how it intersects with the US and trade policy. But today's conversation is really about how the legacy of Mao Zedong's leadership and communist ideology and economic practice influence the Chinese system today, which, as Christopher points out, is a mix of these different systems and legacies. This is also a great episode in the context of last month's 20th Party Congress. So hope you enjoy and would love to hear what folks think. You can email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or comment on the Substack that comes out every Friday. Last but not least, a huge shout out to everyone who has supported the Supercast so far. It's how we pay the bills here and would love to really finish strong with new subscriptions going into the new year. You can go to realignment.supercast.com or click the link at the top of your show notes. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. Chris Marquess, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start with the most basic question. What does the word communism mean today?
That is a good question, because clearly, you know, systems like China are not communist in the traditional way that, like, Karl Marx was saying. They are market-driven economies. And I think it's important to really differentiate the economy from politics. I mean, there is a lot of state intervention in China's economy, and increasingly slow. So a lot of state enterprises. I mean, a lot of, you know, recently sort of forced, you know, investment in some private companies like ByteDance and Alibaba, which you may know. But there is a flourishing market economy in China. The political system, I think, is very authoritarian. So I don't think that's necessarily, you would call it communist. I mean, communist, to your point, means, sort of ownership of assets of society by the people. Karl Marx also described this sort of dictatorship of the proletariat, where, you know, there was sort of an authoritarian type system. So I guess that way the, you know, Chinese government corresponds. But, you know, it's sort of, these political systems have developed over time and not necessarily conform to theory. I mean, as we may talk about, you know, the China's systems are very different than the systems in the USSR as well.
Another question that comes to mind is the 20th century can be framed from a conventional wisdom perspective as liberal democratic capitalism versus autocratic communism, end of history 1990s, liberal capitalism wins. Two questions then. One, would you agree with that framing? And then two, moving out of the 90s, what non-discredited insights does quote-unquote communism maybe offer given the current economic picture?
So the sort of end of history argument, with all sort of due respect to Francis Fukuyama, I 180 degree disagree. I mean, I think that, you know, there has traditionally been this idea in economics development theory that as a country marketized, as the people got sort of materially better off, that they would sort of naturally, transition into, you know, a liberal democracy, basically. And I think the China case has really proven that assumption to be wrong. And I think it's proven it wrong to the, you know, very much sort of negative effects on the United States and U.S. foreign policy, because this was, we sort of believed that as, you know, they were becoming more like us, so to speak, economically, that then, you know, of course they would, you know, adopt a political system like sort of us. And that has not happened. So I think that it's difficult to think about what the alternative theory is. And in some ways, that's what we try to actually do in our book, Mao and Markets, you know, really describe how the depth of ideology and authoritarian systems that exist in China that have been sort of adapted to actually allow for economic growth, you know, are really a very durable system. And I think that given the power that China has taken recently, it's a sort of a scary system as well, I think, for the rest of the world and for the US and the West more generally.
And to the second question, do you think that, once again, when we're saying communism, sure, it's broadly somewhat colloquially applied, do you think it offers any insights for like this present moment? It's easy to say, I think that communism's focus on ownership and questions, sure, of labor, if it's the end of the 19th century, whether or not you agree with Marx, those are useful frames to look at the world that still kind of apply today. Would you say there's something similar today, yes or no?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I do think that, you know, income inequality has skyrocketed in the past 20, 30 years. I do think that actually finding ways to even out and, you know, redistribute some from the sort of rich to the poor, so that there's not such inequality in, you know, that's in the West. You know, China actually talks about this in sort of the common prosperity idea, that, you know, which it dates back to Mao and has now sort of reemerged under under Xi, that that, you know, they want to sort of rob from the rich, give to the poor, is actually how it's sometimes framed. And I think that so I'm all in favor actually of those policies, but the issue I find is that you know, with a country like China or the USSR, you end up having these you know, it's sort of the attempt to implement communism results in authoritarianism. And I think that is something when you see the USSR, which, you know, after it broke up, it results in sort of a new sort of dominant class of oligarchs. And it's not clear that there was anything materially better. I think that, you know, in trying to implement redistribution under a democratic framework is probably a more sustainable way to do it, and actually probably would lead to the betterment of, you know, the sort of the people at the bottom of the ladder, than trying to do it under a sort of authoritarian framework.
Yeah, to your point about authoritarianism, it's one thing to say, hey, like Jack Ma owns this huge tech company and we should redistribute the wealth that was generated from that, and then it's another thing to put him under house arrest. So there's the political dilemma right there.
Totally. And you know, I mean, and if you actually had like consistent and systematic tax structures, but, you know, if you do that, then, you know, you tax on real estate, for instance, you know, all the people, you know, sort of all the people in the CCP leaders don't want that, because that would actually lead to a lot of tax problems for them. And they supposedly, you know, based on their salary from the state, are making very small amounts of money, but actually, you know, they're, you know, as the reporting in the New York Times on Wen Jiabao, the former premier's, you know, having $1.2 billion. I mean, it's, you know, that's not the case. So there's a situation where, you know, yeah, it's very hard to do it in a equitable and fair manner, because the CCP leaders would also end up succumbing to those same structures.
Yeah. So speaking of which, it seems that the useful way to describe this present system is just like Chinese state enterprise, you know, state capitalism, maybe that's interchangeable. How would you really describe that system for folks? It seems like our knowledge of that has really shifted a bit over the past few years.
Yeah, I think that one way to think about it is, you know, is even starting with the sort of the state and the structure of the state. You know, in China, you know, well, let me start with the West. In the West, you know, we have a state and a market, and these are sort of in some ways analytically separate. Of course, there's intermixing. But in China, you know, you have actually the Chinese Communist Party, which sits above the state So actually, when you look at, you know, President Xi, or no, I shouldn't even call him President Xi, you know, Chairman Xi, his most senior position is General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. If you look in provinces and cities, the most senior leader is the Communist Party Secretary. The mayor or governor is actually the second most senior. So they're above the state, they're above the economy. And the thing that really drives this home for me is they're above the military. So the People's Liberation Army does not report into the government of China. It actually reports into the Chinese Communist Party. So, you know, when you think about this idea of sort of state capitalism, I think you have to think about it. So first of all, it's not like the state and the economy are divided separately. So when you talk about things like ownership, there's a lot of state-owned enterprises. You know, I think it was under Jiang Zemin, you know, had this idea of, you know, grasping the, you know, big and letting go of the small, where, you know, the important, you know, telecommunications, financial services, energy, utilities stay as part of the state, but then, you know, other industries get sort of spun off. And so there has been a huge amount of private entrepreneurship. You mentioned Jack Ma as an example, Tencent, even earlier, you know, companies like Huawei or Haier, you know, Huawei telecommunications, Haier makes sort of, you know, white goods type of, you know, type of materials. But even those companies, you know, really, they're very beholden to the government and the state for a variety of, you know, if it's in localities, sort of licenses or siting. Many of the leaders are, you know, sort of members of the Chinese Communist Party. Some of them actually sit on council, you know, sort of the People's Congress or the People's Consultative Congress and other major legislative bodies. So there's party branches or cells, as they're called, that are all throughout these organizations. So, you know, it's people talk a lot about whether the company is state-owned or private-owned. And there's a big controversy around Huawei. Is it state-owned or not? And I think those conversations, while analytically, I guess, important, miss the broader issue that, you know, the CCP is running the show. If it's ownership by the state, that's one method they have. But then there's other mechanisms through, you know, influence on the entrepreneurs, party branches, where they're having a huge influence on these other companies as well.
You know, something I'm curious about, because we're comparing to this 20th century idea here, it seems that the Soviet economy, despite its weaknesses, it could do certain things really well. Right. Obviously, the Soviets get into space before we do. They turn around and obviously there's espionage, but they turn around an atomic bomb really quickly. But at the same time, they weren't able to innovate with computers or microchips. So there's a thing that could do well. These big industrial projects couldn't do the sort of smaller level innovations. So looking at these Chinese state enterprise system today, what do you see it excelling at? And what are areas where it has severe weaknesses that can maybe impede innovation and growth?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I see mostly the negatives, unfortunately, I'm not sure which. Part of the reason is that, you know, there's been a real push on, you know, in some ways, you know, doing everything within China. You know, semiconductors is the sort of the discussion of the day around this. So you have, you know, a real big push to really, you know, have indigenous chip manufacturing, chip fab, chip design. And I think that really runs counter to the way industries and innovation works nowadays. I think that it's a global project. So in semiconductors, for instance, you have, you know, ASML in the Netherlands that is making the key machines. You have, you know, foundries and other machine makers in Korea, Japan, Germany, the US, obviously. And importantly, you know, it's not just about the tech, but it's about the human capital as well. And so, you know, it's not something where a country can just sort of wall itself off, which seems to be, you know, China's strategy. And so I think that, you know, that for the most part, suggests to me that there's, you know, this top-down centralized innovation model is just actually not workable in a lot of industries. That said, trying to think about where maybe China has this model has done well, you know, AI is something that the Chinese government and Communist Party is tremendously focused on. As far as I know, China was the first country that had a national AI strategy published in 2017. And I think, you know, they have invested particularly in a lot of areas that maybe focus on national security, surveillance. So things like, facial recognition. My understanding is China has a bit, you know, that policy focuses tremendously on facial recognition, and China is a leader. Although I think I just read something about the book Surveillance State, which I want to read as well, that actually, you know, when you sort of dig into it, actually, it's a lot of myth and it's not as good as it sounds on the surface. But to me, you know, things where it's about national security and the country will put tremendous energy behind it is an area where I think, you know, maybe they can establish some leadership.
You know, you bringing up the national AI strategy brings up another question. It definitely seems when you're looking at the U.S. domestic political scene, the country feels unfocused. There are always competing instincts and interests. And Right. Do we have a plan for friend shoring or reshoring semiconductors? Is that an actual thing? And you could look at the Chinese model and say, look, they're saying made in China 2025. There's a Belt and Road Initiative, like very, very directly strategically focused. To what degree do you think that matters? Because you did a great piece that I'll link to once again about the semiconductors.
Sure.
The Chinese had the goal of getting to, I think, what was it, like 40% by 2020, right. But they only hit 14%. So does it matter if you can do these big strategies that I'm sure make one feel confident if it's 2014 you're releasing it, but you can't actually meet those numbers? Compare and contrast like the American and Chinese systems in that context.
Sure. I mean, so at a very gross sort of level, I mean, you know, you have top down versus bottom up. I think that things like innovation, bottom up, trial and error, almost like sort of a natural selection process is really, you know, how innovation gets fostered. I think that the semiconductor, as well, you know, if top down spending money, a lot of times actually the KPIs, it's hard to actually align the KPIs with actual real innovation. So what you have
Could you explain KPIs for listeners?
Key performance indicators. These are the things in sort of business or government are the sort of key objectives. And maybe in a policy, might be articulated, to try to get the actors that you're giving money to sort of act towards your goal. And so, for instance, patents is a very well-known, sort of KPI. If you're going to get investment from a government, you know, we want to have, you know, greater amounts of patents. Well, that just actually does not necessarily, patents obviously, you know, are somewhat a loose measure of innovation. But then if patents are just the outcome, then there'll be a lot of sort of low quality, actually not very innovative patents that get produced. And this has been shown, you know, again and again, across the world, that if you focus on something like patents in and of themselves, you know, it just ends up driving up the number of patents. It doesn't actually affect innovation at all. And so I think that's been an issue that China's had. I mean, there's a lot of discussion of, you know, China's patenting, but most of the analyses I've seen suggest that they're actually not super high quality patents. SMIC, which, you know, is perennially, this is China's largest chip fab company. They, you know, have been some of the large, you know, many years, the large, one of the, you know, one of the top 5 or 10 largest patenters in China, but are still many generations behind, you know, TSMC or other leading semiconductor firms. And so also, you know, it does lead to corruption as well when you have these big pots of money. And in the semiconductor industry, you know, there's this, I forget the full name of it, but sort of it was called the Big Fund was the, colloquially is named as, and, you know, there was, you know, people have gone to jail and been persecuted or prosecuted because of misuse of funds. So I think that the top-down approach is a lot I mean, it's great to have money directed to an industry, but there's a lot of areas for waste and corruption, which, you know, ultimately, in many cases, ends up undermining it. I do want to mention one other thing. You mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative. And this is something I think that's really interesting to watch. I know that from what I understand, you know, just, you know, reading news and some of the stuff the Chinese government has been putting out, that China might be backing away from that a bit.
And quick thing, I should have actually defined what, you know, Belt and Road actually is. Please, you're the actual expert. Can you define it and then go on?
So this is an initiative for China to help its companies actually go global in some ways to mostly other sort of emerging and developing economies on infrastructure projects. So, for instance, you know, for building ports in different countries, or railroads, or other, you know, sort of large construction, and then China can help these countries with some of the funding, and Chinese, you know, companies actually get markets for their products. And so, you know, the Belt and Road actually, in theory, I think actually is more effective than some of these other, you know, sort of Made in China 2025, because, you know, China has so topped out in a lot of the infrastructure. You know, this is the way the government keeps the GDP, you know, running over the past, you know, number of decades, is, you know, building lots of amazing infrastructure. And you go to China, I mean, you know, so many times I've taken students to China and they're just like astounded at the railroads, the subways, the buildings, the roads. And this is all, you know, been through, you know, government capital investment in, you know, to make the infrastructure better in some ways, but also to keep the GDP up. And now, saturated with amazing infrastructure, actually finding new markets for that, I think, is a smart development strategy from the government's perspective. Just a quick anecdote on that, just how overly saturated many of China is. In 2020, I took students to China in January before COVID hit. And we were on high-speed rail. We actually took, you know, there's a maglev sort of, it's actually pretty old, you know, that goes from Shanghai, you know, sort of actually have to take a subway or cab to get there, but a little far out in Shanghai to the airport. And students were like, well, how much, you know, high-speed rail does China actually have? And we looked it up, and I forget if it's 30,000 miles or 30,000 kilometers, but they have, you know, around that amount of high-speed rail at the time. The next largest were Japan and Germany, each with about like 3,000 to 4,000. So China is like 10. I mean, China is a large country, bigger than Japan and Germany, obviously, but not 10 times larger, or at least certainly not 10 times larger than Germany. So it's really, I mean, it's totally saturated with high-speed rail, totally saturated airports, you know, ports. And so I think actually the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, from, you know, the Chinese government's standpoint, I mean, you know, provide markets for these companies that have developed amazing technology. But like I mentioned, I from what I heard, they're not as vocal about that anymore. So I'm not sure, you know, what they're thinking. I've lost you audio, Marshall. So unfortunately.
Yeah, if you could actually speak to this, maybe it's not a purposeful contradiction, but when you were talking about the microchips, like semiconductor industry, you were saying a weakness China has is how internally focused the market is, given how global the chip production process is. But we're just talking about Belt and Road.
Right.
Is there a contradiction there, or is there these just entirely two different like industries?
I think, well, the Belt and Road is not necessarily an industry. It is it's across many, many industries, even like, you know, NGOs. I mean, when they even have NGOs sort of going global to help put like a positive shine on, you know, sort of China's, China being, you know, in Africa, you know, lots of resistance to it. So, you know, let's, you know, do some social impact, projects to, you know, sort of make people, you know, like us a bit better, basically. I mean, that's like not a very technical way of saying it, but that's basically it. So, you know, the Belt and Road, I think, is a broader strategy of both of not of, you know, providing new markets. Also, you know, something that has been a big issue for China is that they have a, you know, strong economic power, but very weak soft power. You know, soft power is this idea that, you know, the extent to which, you know, other sort of countries and institutions actually find you sort of attractive as a place and want to do business with you and sort of trust you. And China's been doing very, very poorly on that. And so they also see this as a way of sort of this, you know, establishing a greater global influence. So I see the logic between these two as a bit different, that, you know, they want self-sufficiency in this one key product, semiconductors, but then also want to establish their influence globally a bit more.
Something I'm curious about here, if we're looking at the start of the episode when you're talking about how China in many ways is a repudiation of, like, the, you know, had Francis Fukuyama on the show back in May, so shout out to him, listen to the episode, listeners. But, you know, a repudiation to the end of history idea. I wonder, to what degree is the Chinese economic model's success and the ability to retain the authoritarian political model dependent on continued economic growth and success? Like, you've written about rural China, just outside of just like the obvious, like, coastal regions. Is it just possible that the second the Chinese economic model struggles, you run into a demographic issue, they are no longer able to essentially have it both ways? So what I'm basically asking you is, right, like, to what extent should we remain confident, for good or for ill, in the Chinese economic model's success moving into the set of challenges one can predict they're going to have this century?
Yeah, no, really, really good question. I think this is, I mean, I don't know what keeps Xi Jinping up at night, but I think that, you know, if I were him, this would be what would keep me up at night, actually, because, you know, they, in political science, there's this sort of theory around responsive authoritarianism. You know, you think about countries like, you know, North Korea as an example. I mean, you know, that have really, you know, they're authoritarian in a very much strong, coercive and control fashion. But China really, you know, has a bargain with its people. You know, we will continue to, you know, in some ways deliver this, you know, sort of China dream. You know, you can, and this is sort of the take on, this is not actually what they mean by the China dream. This is sort of the Americanized version of China dream. You know, you'll continue to keep getting economically better individually. So you'll, you know, won't think about the fact that your internet is censored. You won't think about the fact that, you know, there's crackdowns in industry, or that you're, you know, sort of governed by a set of people that is not necessarily representative of you, but you're doing better economically, so you're happy. So that is, I think, this political science theory that is, you know, sort of pretty deeply thought to be the, you know, what happens. And so I do think that once China's economy starts, you know, hitting road bumps, which it certainly has over the past number of years, it's in danger, you know, we're in danger in the world of actually China lashing out to, like, something, you know, something like, you know, doing something in Taiwan, or maybe some of the more strident nationalistic things against companies in China or against the US. Because another part of this, in some ways, responsive authoritarian idea is that, you know, sort of this economic prosperity is one pillar, but then also, you know, in some ways, safeguarding national integrity and borders. And so if the economic pillar is not working, let's just sort of, you know, crank up the propaganda to get people behind us, you know, through, you know, these things like potentially attacking Taiwan, or, you know, attacking, you know, sort of US or other companies. So I do think, and, you know, it's, I think your underlying point is spot on. And yeah, I mean, China has these demographic, you know, issues, which is a big deal. I think this is another reason why the Belt and Road is important, because to them, you know, if they can begin, you know, sort of gaining wealth from globalization, this in some ways offsets, you know, the sort of the decline in domestic income and sort of, you know, older population that will need a lot of social service benefits. I mean, you think about like a country like the UK, a very small country where I am now, you know, very small country, but for a long time was really very dominant because of its global empire, so to speak. And I think that China, I wouldn't be surprised if they, not explicitly trying to imitate the UK, but actually trying to create a global set of economic drivers that can somehow offset this demographic issue that they'll have. Not to go on too long, but I also want to mention
this is your show, so please.
This issue of what keeps Xi Jinping up at night, and I think this is where it's really difficult to sort of diagnose or sort of understand, what his motivations are, because clearly he has made a lot of, in the CCP, sort of policy actions that suggest that actually ideology is much more important than economics. We saw under Mao that sort of leads to disaster. And, you know, there's clearly with COVID, there's been huge economic decline. You know, much of these private businesses, the CCP has taken a much more active role in them. And so I wonder in which that actually is keeping up at night. And that is sort of worrying to me, because that actually is a question that you asked that should be keeping up at night, and how to keep sort of the economic engine going.
The ideology over economics point is really interesting. I want to stay there for a second. So you alluded, and this is a good pivot to Chinese leadership, to Mao choosing these ideological objectives over pure economics. And obviously these are economic challenges, industrialization, seen through and often fueled in search of ideological ends. So can you really talk about the Mao example, that you flesh out the example you're kind of giving there?
Sure. Yeah. So this idea of, ideology of economics, Mao is one of the history's, I guess, more famous examples of this. You know, one aspect of this were these campaigns that he had, which we talk about in our book. You know, the most famous of them is A Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. I'll just say a little about The Great Leap Forward. I mean, this was a campaign that Mao initiated in the late 1950s to try to catch up and surpass. I think it was like, you know, catch up to the UK, surpass, or vice versa. So surpass the UK, so catch up to the US in steel production. And so the sort of strategy to do that was to collectivize everyone so that, you know, you could have, you know, a lesser number of people, you know, plant the fields, harvest the fields, you'd have communal dining, and everyone individually wouldn't need things like, you know, pots and pans and spoons and everything, because these will all be part of the, you know, communal dining area. You could burn these down into, burn these down into steel. Well, you know, backyard furnaces is what the sort of actually smelting operations were called. Well, it turns out that steel made that way is actually useless. And it turns out too that actually you had a bunch of shirking, and people actually didn't take care of the fields. And then right after the Great Leap Forward, or towards the end and right after, you know, sort of it concluded, you had this great famine where, I've seen estimates all over the place, but I think, you know, one that is pretty widely acknowledged is greater than 30 million people starved to death in this, you know, famine. So, you know, much greater than many of the other tragedies of the 20th century, much greater number of deaths. This is an example where, you know, Mao's ideology, you know, really dictated, the sort of economic plans and led to, you know, all kinds of inflations of crop yields. And sort of like the semiconductor example, you know, if, you know, there's a KPI to have crop yields, I mean, people end up sort of inflating that. And, you know, there's sort of numbers that are, you know, way, way beyond what even can be produced with, you know, most advanced planting and GMO technology today. Cultural Revolution is another example of these sort of campaigns that really were destructive, ideological campaigns which were destructive economically. And this was a campaign to really revitalize the revolutionary spirit in China, and was basically a decade from the, you know, the mid-1960s, mid-1970s of sort of disorder, no rule of law, you know, these Red Guards, which were these sort of, you know, teenage groups of you know, former students, but classes had closed, you know, schools had closed, you know, persecuting people that had the wrong background or you know, sort of ideas they didn't like. And so
and she himself and his family, could you were captured in this, if you could expand on that part?
Sure, yeah. So his father, you know, Xi's father was a senior leader in the early days of the Chinese Communist Party. I think he was an early sort of minister of propaganda. He was one of the sort of people that was criticized and sort of ousted during that time period. He later came back and actually ended up being the governor of Guangdong province, which is where Shenzhen is. And at least in Xi's rewriting of history, his father gets a lot of credit for the opening up there in post Mao's death. Xi himself was one of the individuals that was actually part of this movement, was actually sending people to the countryside. So kids that were grew up in urban areas, you know, they're not getting the true revolutionary spirit that the peasants in China are. So millions of Chinese youth were sent to the countryside to work in rural areas, in agrarian, you know, sort of pursuits. And Xi spent 7 years doing this, you know. So his schooling effectively ended when he was 15 years old. He was sent to the countryside and worked as a laborer in, you know, in the fields.
Something I'm curious about, and this is why the economics over ideology question seems to be the key issue that could determine the next decade, the next several decades. Right. If you're looking at China's state of affairs right now, China needs to import food. So much of global trade, which the country is dependent on, obviously goes through South China Sea, all these parts of the world that could really be blown up literally and figuratively, right, should there be any conflict over Taiwan or in the broader region. So on a pure rationality basis, it seems like that's just a bad idea. And I know there's this like complicated thing about Taiwan, but let's get real for a second. Risking all that destruction wouldn't be worth it. But the example then, to your point, of 20 million people dying in the face of an ineffective, like unachievable, like this goal wasn't actually achieved, that would make one draw a pause on whether or not a gamble like that is willing to be made. So to what degree do you think China, and this is where Maoist principles come into effect, this is kind of the point of the book, to what degree do you think China is still the same country in terms of being willing to take those risks, or should we be focusing more on the individual level? To what degree is Xi a leader like Mao Zedong who would do those actual moves himself?
So I would put, so I think that there's much to be said about Xi and also the CCP system, so to speak. And I think that, you know, we saw it in the, you know, 20th Party Congress, which was this, you know, every 5 year sort of leadership conference of the party conference. So it's not the government, it's the Communist Party, where, you know, they set leadership and objectives, and it's all basically sort of Xi's cronies are in the top echelon. You know, it's interesting, coming back a little bit to his experience in Cultural Revolution, you know, there's research in economics, political science, and also one chapter in our book that looks at how, having gone through the Cultural Revolution, has led, you know, Chinese that have gone through it in more extreme ways to have lesser trust in others, sort of less sort of belief in institutional systems. And this is, you know, in our book, we look at entrepreneurs, but the economics and psychology study, or economics and political science studies, look more broadly. So this is something that I think, you know, I think this sort of lack of trust in institutional norms, which certainly, you know, follows Mao, is something that is really prominent in Xi, and why he has to, you know, point all of his cronies, so to speak, because those are the people who he trusts. You know, having the more sort of shared leadership model, which existed in the past, where, you know, the previous leaders and people from other sort of factions all sort of came together, you know, it just doesn't work for Xi. I mean, he wants, you know, to be just sort of the big time man in charge. And I think that, you know, in regards to coming back to your question, you know, I, like you, I feel like rationally, it just makes no sense. We see, you know, what happened in, you know, it's happened in Ukraine. We see, you know, what huge destruction, or which no doubt huge economic destruction it would have. But, you know, in some ways, you know, I think that the belief that of sort of following sort of the principles of sort of nationalism ideology could potentially, you know, sort of sway the day, so to speak. And particularly if there's more and more economic problems, and Xi feels really sort of backed into a corner to prove himself, you know, something drastic could possibly happen.
Yeah, and I want to clarify, obviously, like taking the Xi or, you know, CCP perspective on this, obviously, they are going to want to bring Taiwan officially back into, you know, mainland right. China. That's obviously going to be the objective. The real debate for me is like, are you patient about that objective, or right. do you need to force it? Because it seems yeah. like the patient version, the patient and confident version of this is, look, we're crushing these economically. Chinese soft power is at the max. We'd have the China dream, Belt and Road, Made in China 2025. Like the Western democratic system's on the is clearly on the downfall. And at that point, you're going to want to have like the Taiwanese are going to want to reintegrate into China. That's right. the confident, patient version. It just seems that it's pretty clear that faith in the confident, patient version is really wearing thin.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's sort of, I appreciate you mentioning confident, because this is the thing, you know, so many times when I'm in China and you'll see these things, you'll think like, wow, this is a big display of insecurity. The fact that, you know, someone slightly criticizes you and you have to sort of go after them in such extreme ways. I mean, that is just, to me, and I mean, I think implicit from what you're saying, you know, that just suggests like a level of insecurity that is hard to imagine that, you know, sort of the leader of China would have, but clearly been proven again and again that yes, he actually is that thin-skinned and insecure. And so it's what makes, you know, me worried about his actions, and every action that he takes, it seems, is just, you know, further along that path.
Something I'm curious about, two questions related to Mao, right? So obviously, I'd love to hear you just articulate like what Maoist principles are in this context.
Sure.
But then two, a key thing that Xi has done is work to rehabilitate Mao within China's like modern conception of itself.
Sure.
It's not as, you know, with Stalin, where Khrushchev literally gives this big yeah. speech denouncing it, and that is part of Russia's reconciliation with its decline after the 1990s. Putin is rehabilitating Stalin, but there is a degree of like pushback on Mao, at least during the Deng Xiaoping period. So just tell this story.
Sure. So yeah, so a couple sort of threads in there that are important. So I think the one thing that is most important to understanding, I don't know, sort of modern current China is sort of this invented term that the Chinese have called historical nihilism. And what this means is that there is a correct view of history, and it is one that celebrates Mao, celebrates the CCP. And these are some of the insecurity moves that I, you know, sort of alluded to. People that, you know, go against sort of the CCP accepted view of history are considered historical nihilists and are basically thrown in jail. And the reason why that is so important to the CCP, and as you mentioned, you know, there has been this, I mean, you know, somewhat rehabilitation. And I say somewhat because I think always Mao was really deeply, well thought of. But in the most recent sort of official history, you know, he got, you know, a lot more flowery language, so to speak, and many of his, you know, so-called, you know, mistakes or that used to be called mistakes sort of got whitewashed a bit. And, you know, there's not as much on the Cultural Revolution or the Great Leap Forward and stuff. So I totally am with you. And the reason why that is important is for what you were mentioning about the, you know, the Soviet Union, the sort of idea in, you know, in China is that Khrushchev and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, you know, created tremendous errors in negating Stalin because it actually undermined belief in the populace and in the party in the efficacy of the Communist Party, so to speak. And so this is, and that this actually created a downward spiral that led to the, you know, eventual decline. So this is really what, you know, the Chinese are trying to avoid. They even had, you know, around the centenary of the Communist Party, a documentary movie series, you know, that sort of showed that, you know, how, you know, why the Soviet Union fell because of these reasons and how, you know, the Communist Party of China is attempting to sort of hold on to its history in really strong ways.
So for this last section, we haven't really spoken about Deng Xiaoping much. So he's obviously the Mao successor who really plays a role in opening right. China to the world, kind of setting up the conventional wisdom about China no longer being a purely communist country that succeeds by reforming itself in a way that glasnost and perestroika under the Soviet Union did not succeed. The thing that's really interesting, though, is I think there's this quote from you in one of your pieces where you say that the way we typically tell the story of, let's say, the Chinese leaders who most Americans will have heard of, so Mao, Deng, right. and now Xi, is, wow, we had this liberalizing moment under Deng, learning the lessons of Mao. It's crazy that Xi is doing all these things. The point that you kind of make is Deng should be thought of as the aberration. It's actually a much clearer through line to Xi Jinping's approach to the world and his thought than there would be from Deng. So just explain right. this part. I thought that was a really fascinating way to frame it.
Sure. Yeah. And so first of all, I mean, you know, you know, this reform and opening that you described in the late 1970s after Mao passed away, where, you know, as it says, you know, reform, going to reform the economy, opening up, you know, try to get more global trade. So what Deng set forth in the late 1970s, he sort of called sort of two basic points. So that was actually the second basic point. The first basic point, and they have all these this jargon, which now that's becoming, you know, sort of sounding pretty bad in English, but it was like the four cardinal principles. And basically it was sort of Maoism at the core, CCP in the lead, and holding on to socialism. So that was actually seen as even more fundamental as a point than reform and opening up. Many of his successors, you know, Jiang Zemin actually started this trend of having party branches or party cells within companies. You know, Hu Jintao, you know, sort of had this philosophy of, you know, the private retreats and the state sort of regains its you know, sort of power. So I do think that there is this, you know, sort of a Maoist in some ways through line in spite of actually opening the economy. And Deng Xiaoping, I think, was really very brilliant in the way that he did that, brilliant in many ways. I mean, so he actually understood that actually markets, you know, are in some ways a tool and that they can actually be used within a sort of authoritarian or, you know, communist system to actually drive economic, you know, sort of prosperity, but actually still it's the CCP and the communists that are in charge. And so, you know, sort of came back to our, you know, initial where you're at, where it's trying to differentiate between sort of the economic system and the political system. You know, I think that he really very insightfully saw, you know, just by having markets does not necessarily undermine our communist identity. And so I think that, you know, that's, you know, the through line. And in the West, we sort of, I think, see that as, oh, you know, markets are coming in. That's actually very connected to the political, you know, political transition as well. And you know, that I don't think was ever on the table in China.
So would love to just get a quick sum up reaction to the 20th Party Congress then that recently wrapped, obviously extending Xi's power. But I think it really, if we're thinking about this conversation, like so much of it is summed up, and I think in what basically happened.
Right, exactly. No, I mean, I think, you know, this, yeah, so as you mentioned, you know, so Xi, you know, he's sort of large in charge. I mean, you know, I think, you know, people speculate that possibly the Hu Jintao episode, where he was sort of ushered out, you know, no one knows exactly why.
This is Xi's direct predecessor.
His direct predecessor who was sitting next to him. And then all of a sudden, you know, Xi's bodyguards come and basically forcibly lift him up and take him out. The Chinese government or the CCP explanation is he had health concerns. But if you see the videos, I mean, at least my interpretation is that, I mean, this is not some purge, but this is something that, you know, perhaps Hu Jintao saw that maybe his preferred candidates, you know, Li Keqiang, who's a former premier, you know, he was actually part of the Hu Jintao camp. And there's another guy named Wang Yang. We're not part of the sort of final list. And he was sort of getting a little bit excited. And there was some shuffling of papers around. And that was just not the kind of, you know, outburst you have in these highly planned affairs. And so, you know, it seems strange to me that he would not have been told or that would not have been settled before. But it does, you know, that is in, I mean, your viewers should watch the video if they haven't already, but, you know, everyone is so, you know, stone-faced. I mean, he walks past at least like 20 of his colleagues, people he's worked with for decades. No one sort of turns and looks at him and sort of gives him sort of a thoughtful glance or anything. It's just all straight, you know. And so this is, you know, that sort of, I think more than anything, encapsulates the level of sort of control and authority that Xi has established, and, you know, his third term, you know, stacking the standing committee of the Politburo with his, you know, sort of chosen candidates. And it's, you know, the ironic thing is that so many times people have talked about how, you know, the CCP is meritocratic, sort of building on this, you know, Confucian system that has existed for 1,000 years. But, you know, the sort of the mayor or the party secretaries of Shanghai and Beijing who had horrible COVID responses actually were appointed to that group. So people say this really has undermined the idea that China has any sort of meritocracy in its promotion of leaders.
So for the wrapping question, you also have written in a piece that we'll link in the show notes that Xi thinks of semiconductors, microchips in the same way that Mao really prioritized steel as like that central marker of state-based economic success in the 20th and now then 21st century at the chips example. So I would just love to hear your closing thoughts on how the U.S., as you see it, the U.S.'s economic system really stacks up against against this Chinese competition, given the framework we've just outlined in this episode.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the U.S. has tons of problems. I mean, I think that the sort of political divisiveness now, you know, makes it hard to actually get anything done. I do think, though, that, you know, I mean, the sort of, you know, cross the aisle agreement that, you know, we need to actually compete in the 21st century against, you know, this major country that may potentially threaten our values and way in life has brought people together in ways that maybe they hadn't been in the past. And I am a supporter of, you know, sort of hardline competition against China in taking a variety of ways. I mean, I think that the CHIPS Act is a good step. I think an even better step is actually the executive order that Biden introduced that said that people that are U.S. citizens or green card holders cannot work for chip companies or, you know, machine tool companies that actually are supplying China the critical, you know, military or high sort of high tech chips. And I think that is the kind of sort of hardball that we need to be playing and thinking about. And I hope that, you know, that Biden and whoever, you know, is president after 2024 continues to push forward in advancing America's interests in these critical industries.
I think what you just said is really the interesting story of the Trump and then Biden years, is just the through line between the policy approach specifically. Chris, this has been really helpful. If you're watching this on YouTube, we had the book's cover up here at the front of the episode. But could you just shout the book out and make any, if folks are interested in this, like in this space, any recommendations you'd offer to delve a little deeper?
Sure. The book is called Mao and Markets. I don't know if they can see it, but it's right over this my left shoulder here. And I appreciate you showing it on the show as well. And I think they can certainly, you know, look for it on Amazon or other retailers. Feel free to send me an email if they have any further questions.
Great. Chris, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Yeah, Marshall, thanks so much. Really enjoyed our discussion.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.